From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Alzheimer's disease affects at least 5.5 million people in the United States. One of the challenges in trying to treat the disease is catching it early enough. There's currently no reliable way to diagnose Alzheimer's until symptoms like memory loss are already recognizable. And by that time, the brain has suffered years, if not decades, worth of damage. That's likely why many promising drug trials in recent years have failed. Now, new research could lead to a test capable of diagnosing Alzheimer's years before there are any symptoms. Researchers from Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis say they can use a combination of a blood test, a genetic test, and a patient's age to predict with 94% accuracy whether or not a person will develop Alzheimer's. Suzanne Schindler is an assistant professor of neurology at Washington University in St. Louis and lead author on that new study. Suzanne, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with this blood test that you've been working with. You're not the only one trying to develop a blood test for Alzheimer's. That's kind of been a holy grail of Alzheimer's research in recent years. And you test for one of two really well-known proteins involved in Alzheimer's. You're looking at amyloid beta. So what is new or different about the blood test that you've been working with?
So we look at two forms of amyloid beta. So we look at one form that's 40 amino acids long and one that's slightly longer, 42 amino acids. But what we found is that the ratio of those two proteins is very accurate in predicting whether someone has early Alzheimer's disease brain changes.
So how do you even test something like that and come to the conclusion that it is indeed an accurate test? How long do you have to follow patients to determine whether or not your diagnosis was in fact correct and these people do in fact develop Alzheimer's disease?
That's a little complicated. So what we used as our gold standard in this case was actually not whether someone had clinical symptoms. So what we used is what is very well established in the field as a marker of Alzheimer's brain changes, and that's a special brain scan called amyloid PET. What our study did is it looked to see whether our test predicted the results of this amyloid PET scan. And what we found, which was interesting, is that our blood test, we could see that it became positive before the threshold that we typically use for this amyloid PET scan became positive. So the blood test was very sensitive to these early brain changes.
And how accurate was that blood test alone? Because, as I said, others have been working on blood tests to detect early Alzheimer's and have been somewhere in the range of maybe 85-90% accuracy. How good could you get with the blood test alone?
So it was 88%. And when we added these additional factors, whether or not you have this version of the gene, ApoE epsilon 4 or not, as well as age, then we could get to 94%.
Suzanne Schindler, when you do this combined test, the genetic test and the amyloid beta ratio test, do we understand biologically why those two factors together would be such a strong indicator of whether or not a person will develop Alzheimer's?
So we know that that blood test is very accurate in predicting whether someone has these amyloid plaques in their brain, as shown by this test. What a future study needs to be done, and we're working on doing this, is actually showing the connection between these plaques in the brain and clinical symptoms. We know that there's a very strong risk associated with having high levels of amyloid plaque, but we're still figuring out the factors that modify whether or not you have clinical symptoms as a function of the amount of amyloid plaque in your brain. So it's actually a little bit complex. So this test is really for the amyloid brain changes, not for clinical symptoms of Alzheimer's disease.
Suzanne Schindler, you've said that this test, when you put together the amyloid beta blood test, the ApoE gene test, and the age factor, that you get 94% accuracy in predicting, as you said, the brain changes, not necessarily symptomatic Alzheimer's, but the brain changes that might lead to Alzheimer's disease. what does 94% accuracy actually mean? I mean, how often would this test miss a case of Alzheimer's, and how often might this test generate a false positive and predict that someone would get Alzheimer's when in fact they don't?
Well, the 94% that we're saying is actually based on a certain statistical measure. There's actually quite a few other statistical measures of accuracy. Accuracy is a pretty complex study to figure out how accurate an assay is. It really depends on where you draw your cutoffs. So, for example, if I draw a low cutoff, then everyone above that cutoff is positive, we can make the test very sensitive. So we're not going to miss very many people. If, on the other hand, we have a high bar, so we say that you have to have a very abnormal test result, then we may not have quite so many false positives, but then we have a false negatives. The reason that we've used this 94% measure, it's called a receiver operating characteristic area under the curve.
A little bit of a mouthful.
Yeah. It actually looks at all potential cutoffs. So if you look at all potential cutoffs, how good is that test? So it's kind of a little bit of an agnostic measure, which is why I like it. In other words, we're not arbitrarily drawing a line here so that we get the results that we want. So that's why we're using that particular measure in terms of accuracy. And again, something that was interesting in this study is that we found that if you have this gene form, APOE epsilon 4, and also depending on your age, the cut points are essentially different. And so it may not be that you can use the same cutoff for the test for everyone, but what really adds to the accuracy of the test is you are essentially making different cutoffs for people in different categories. And I think something that's going to be really important going forward is I think it's likely that there are additional factors that affect where you should draw those cutoffs. We did find a little evidence that sex plays a role, so that males and females may actually have slightly different levels. In our sample, this didn't quite improve the accuracy significantly if we included sex, but I think that if we run this in a larger group of people, we may see an effect.
How do you imagine something like this test being incorporated into a clinical setting, and how long do you think that would take? I mean, given all of these complexities, it sounds like there's a lot still to work out.
What we are primarily interested in using the test for in the very near future, in the next year or two, is to help us screen people for clinical trials for drugs for Alzheimer's disease. A lot of the drug trials that have been done so far have used patients who have significant symptoms and are pretty far along in the course of the disease, and it's much harder to reverse a disease than to prevent it. So we really need to find a way to figure out who's at risk and enroll them in studies before they even have symptoms. And we have this amyloid PET scan, which has actually been used for clinical prevention trials, but it's very expensive. It's about $4,000 or $5,000, requires a lot of coordination to set up all of these scans, interpret the results. And the drug trials that have used it have been very expensive and taken a lot of time to enroll patients. So we think that by using this blood test that we could recruit people much more quickly and much faster, and that would really translate to Alzheimer's disease drug trials being cheaper and faster. And hopefully that will mean that we can find a drug that works faster.
Do you think that actually using a test like this that detects potential early changes related to Alzheimer's disease even earlier than the scan does could actually change the result of previous drug trials? I mean, if we were to go back and try those drugs again with patients whose potential Alzheimer's is found earlier, could those drugs perhaps be effective when they weren't before?
So I don't know, but my guess is I think it's quite possible that some of these drugs that were tested and failed simply because we tested on people who were too far along in the course of the disease. So yes, I actually think it's quite possible that we may have tested drugs that would have worked had we tried them earlier in the course of the disease. Now, I don't know whether drug companies are going to want to make another big investment on these drugs that haven't previously worked in trials. But I think that part of developing a drug is understanding the biology of the disease and finding a drug that affects that biology. But part of it is really treating the disease at the right time. And that's something that we've come to appreciate more and more. And I think that this blood test is really going to be a game changer in terms of letting us treat the disease before people get symptoms. Now, I'm a clinician, I'm a neurologist, and I see patients with dementia. And one thing in the clinic is that many of the patients who come to see me, it's not totally clear what is causing their symptoms. So I think that in the clinic, this test would be very helpful. I don't think it's quite there yet, but I don't think it's that far off. I think that within maybe 3 to 5 years that this sort of test could be available for clinical use. The idea of using a test like this in someone who doesn't have clinical symptoms is something that's quite a bit further off for a variety of reasons. One of those is we don't have effective treatments right now. So if we test someone and they're positive and they don't have clinical symptoms, there's not necessarily a lot they can do about it. And so we don't do any of these advanced diagnostic procedures right now on patients who don't have significant symptoms. But I think that would absolutely change if we get a drug that works. So I'm hoping that 5-10 years from now, we find a drug that is effective at preventing or delaying the onset of Alzheimer's disease symptoms caused by these Alzheimer's disease brain changes, and that you can go to your doctor and get a test like this as part of your regular annual exam, and they can say, oh, it looks like your test is abnormal, you need to start on this drug. Just like you're started on a drug for your high cholesterol or your borderline diabetes, and then you never develop Alzheimer's disease. So that's the dream. I think we're still a ways off from that. But I think these are the sorts of questions and goals that are now seeming much more realistic than they were even a few years ago.
Suzanne Schindler is an assistant professor of neurology at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis and lead author on a new study showing that a combination of a blood test, a genetic test, and age can be highly effective for early diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. Suzanne, thanks so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Up next, rare diseases may affect relatively small groups of people, but understanding them can benefit all of us. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Niemann-Pick disease type C. Unless you know someone who's had it, you've probably never heard of it. It's a rare genetic disease that disrupts the movement of cholesterol and other fats around within cells. The end result varies widely from death in the first few months of life to mild chronic problems that may go undiagnosed well into adulthood. Niemann-Pick is just one of many rare diseases. Each may affect only a small percentage of the population, but that does not make such conditions any less devastating for those who have them. And it presents unique challenges for the researchers trying to find treatments and cures for these diseases. Challenges like limited funding and a limited number of people to take part in trials. But rare disease research can yield discoveries that impact all of us. Stephen Sturley is a professor in the Department of Pediatrics at Columbia University and at Barnard College. He's a member of the Scientific Advisory Board for the National Niemann-Pick Disease Foundation. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Introduce us to Niemann-Pick disease and the fact that there's a type C suggests that there's also a type A and a type B.
That's right. Niemann-Pick type C disease is a disease that falls into classification known as lysosomal storage disorders. Both Niemann-Pick A and Niemann-Pick B are due to deficiencies in an enzyme that breaks down lipids. Niemann-Pick type C, however, is a disease that arises from a mutation in a gene that transports lipids into the lysosome.
And the lysosome is a part of the cell?
The lysosome is the garbage bag of the cell. That's where recycling of lipids takes place, and that's where lipids get broken down. And so in a lysosomal storage disorder, these lipids accumulate in the lysosome and either block the lysosome from functioning or deprive the cell of the lipids which are needed for membrane formation.
And you said the other two types, the A and the B, are deficiencies. So the end result of all of these types of Niemann-Pick is not enough cholesterol or not enough of certain fats?
Either not enough cholesterol and certain fats, or the cholesterol accumulates, which then causes the lysosome to generally misfunction.
And what are the symptoms of the disease?
So all three diseases are neurodegenerative in that although every organ in the body is affected by loss of these genes, the main organs that get affected are the brain.
So we're used to thinking of a cholesterol-related disease as being like a heart disease,
this
is actually a neurodegenerative, a brain condition.
It's certainly the fatalities that arise are due to neurodegeneration.
So how many people have a Niemann-Pick disease of one type or another?
So Niemann-Pick type C affects about 1 in 90,000 people, which means that in the current census, there are about 400 families in the U.S. that are affected by this disease.
And it's a genetic disease, but it's really variable in the outcomes. I mean, how unusual is that for a genetic disease?
Well, recessive disorders tend to be somewhat variable because a lot of families have different mutations. The disease can vary from a very early age of onset when the protein is completely misfunctional to a disease that manifests in late 60s at its most extreme.
That's got to make it really hard to diagnose.
It's very hard to diagnose. The time to diagnosis is at least 5 years. And since most of the most common variants of the disease show up around about 5 or 6, most of these children don't really get a diagnosis until their mid-teens. And unfortunately, at that point in time, most neurons have been damaged by the loss of this protein. And it's very hard to treat at that stage because the damage has already been done.
Right. You can't go back and regrow those neurons.
You can't regenerate neurons in general. Some areas of the brain do regenerate neurons, but in the cerebellum, that doesn't happen. And so this is mainly a cerebellar disease.
That's a specific case where it's difficult to make the diagnosis for a number of reasons, but that's not unusual for rare diseases as a whole. When you have something that doctors don't see every day, it often takes a while for the medical system as a whole to figure out what's going on with a patient with a rare disease.
That's correct, yeah. And, these diseases are very hard to treat because the treatment that's available are only currently coming into clinical trials. Nevertheless, being a neurodegeneration, picking the disease up late causes a problem with any sort of treatment that's going to be used.
In the case of Niemann-Pick type C, you know the gene responsible. Is this something that could just be universal genetic testing?
It really should be, yes. And there are several reasons why it should be. The first reason is that the time to diagnosis is 5 years, and the time to manifestation of symptoms is often not until age 6 or 7, sort of starting school. And so by the time these children get to the age of 11 or 12, most of the damage has been done. And so to have a screening being done of all populations for this disease would be the most sensible strategy to use. And in these days of genome sequencing, it's not a hard task to screen for these diseases.
Stephen Sturley, as a researcher, how did you originally get interested in this one particular rare disease, Niemann-Pick type C?
So my research interest has always been how cholesterol is moved around the body. And I started, as you were saying in your introduction, about looking at mainly atherosclerosis and heart disease. And then I stumbled across this disease, both in a sort of quest for funding for my research in general, but also out of curiosity, in that this transporter, this protein that is defective in Niemann-Pick type C, seemed like it was an unusual pathway that had not been investigated.
You mentioned funding for your research. That's often a challenge with these rare diseases. So how do you fund your research on this?
So the majority of my funding has come from a foundation called the Ira Parseghian Medical Research Foundation. It was unfortunate that this family had 3 affected children. Ira Parseghian was a football coach for Notre Dame, and he and his family set up their own research foundation where their goal was to raise money and funnel that money directly into research. And as a consequence, they made research funding available to a lot of researchers, and I was one of the first people to be funded. And this was back in the days before the gene was cloned. This predates the time of genome sequencing, so the gene was cloned in a somewhat old-fashioned molecular biology approach Like many of these situations, a lot of people hoped and maybe assumed that cloning the gene would lead to a cure. And unfortunately, the nature of this protein does not actually produce that result, unfortunately.
The kind of research you're describing is labor-intensive. And even now, when we do have all of these advances in genetic sciences, it's still expensive and time-consuming research.
Correct.
And when you're trying to fund that through family foundations, you know, compare the scale of funding to something like cancer research or Alzheimer's research or some of these other kind of higher profile biomedical research programs that we see heavily funded at the national level.
Right. So I do receive funding from the NIH, and so do many of my colleagues. And so the NIH is not ungenerous in its support of rare diseases. And part of the reason for that is they recognize that investigating rare diseases has a lot of consequences for more prevalent diseases that are in the population. The interesting thing about Niemann-Pick type C is that it also happens to be the cellular receptor for the Ebola virus.
Ebola virus?
That's right, yes.
What's the connection between Ebola and cholesterol?
It's unclear exactly at the moment, but it's well known now that the Ebola virus, as part of its life cycle, has to get into the lysosome. And it turns out that the Niemann-Pick type C protein, which is found on the surface of this garbage bag of the cell, is the actual cellular receptor for the Ebola virus.
So it's the thing that would kind of grab the virus and put it into there.
So once the virus has got inside the cell, the next stage of its life cycle is to get into the lysosome and move on to the next part of its life cycle. And if you don't have the Niemann-Pick C protein, then one prediction would be that you'd be resistant to the Ebola virus.
I would assume that research on something like Niemann-Pick type C, and more broadly, as you were saying, with your research on cholesterol, when you're funding research on a rare disease that affects the movement of cholesterol, that could also have ramifications for a whole host of other cholesterol-related health
impacts. There are very strong suggestions that Alzheimer's disease is affected by at least the cholesterol status of the brain, and the way in which that cholesterol is controlled in the brain is certainly in part a component of the Niemann-Pick type C protein. And so that type C protein might be involved in, for example, Alzheimer's or Huntington's disease.
Well, Stephen Sirley, you were mentioning that it's been, something like 20 years since you did uncover what gene is responsible for Niemann-Pick disease type C, but that there's still, that hasn't led immediately to a treatment or a cure. And That's something we've also seen far more broadly. There was this idea, especially with the Human Genome Project, like we're going to figure out all of our DNA, and within 10 years, we will have revolutionized all of medicine. And more than 10 years later, a lot of people are sitting around going, what happened to the promise of genome biology of, you know, if we understand our genes, we'll solve all of our diseases? Obviously, it's not that simple.
It's not that simple. And a lot of it comes down to how hard a nut is it to crack in terms of looking at the particular protein that's defective in disease. And the current treatment that actually is in FDA trials is actually a component called beta-cyclodextrin. This is the active component of Febreze.
Okay, wait. Febreze, like the anti-odor spray.
Yeah. So the anti-odor spray that you spray when your dog has got on your settee, is the active component is called beta-cyclodextrin. That beta-cyclodextrin is actually a cage-like molecule that traps the odorant. Therefore, you can't smell it anymore.
How did the idea come about to use Febreze to treat a disease?
So it was pure scientific serendipity. In other words, it was the compound that was used to actually solubilize another drug that was being tested for treatment of Niemann-Pick type C disease. And after a series of experiments, it was discovered that the Febreze compound was actually the active compound rather than the drug candidate that was being looked at.
So it was just coincidence that it was being used to dissolve a totally different drug, but it was actually what was...
It was actually the active compound.
So the protein that causes Niemann-Pick type C is also the Ebola receptor.
Yes.
The treatment currently being tested for this disease is actually an ingredient in Febreze. I mean, these are wild and unexpected connections.
That's right. A lot of tangents.
To so many different things. Is that unique to Niemann-Pick type C disease? Or do you think this is something that if we looked at a lot of rare diseases, we just don't necessarily know what those connections are for all these different rare diseases, but they're there?
It's hard to say whether it's specific for Niemann-Pick type C. I think one thing that it is reflecting is the way in which research funding has been produced by this foundation, by the Ara Pasignan Medical Research Foundation. They were very open-minded about funding anybody who had an idea to study this disease, which means that a lot of people come from it from different directions. And like most things in scientific research, a lot of this has been fortuitous.
Obviously, there are challenges in rare disease research that can't be solved with money, right? That's not going to increase your population size
Correct.
For clinical
Yep.
trials. But a lot of this seems to come back to money. And I wonder what your thoughts are on what we should be doing, perhaps differently, or if there is anything that we could or should be doing differently in terms of funding rare disease research to try to get to treatments and cures for these diseases, but also in recognition of, as we've talked about, the fact that studying rare diseases and just interesting basic biological processes can lead to all sorts of discoveries that we couldn't possibly have predicted.
I think that the future is not quite so pessimistic as it might be. In other words, there's a definite awareness that studying rare diseases has benefit for the larger populations. There's a definite awareness among drug companies that this is not a dead end in terms of just curing a disease for a limited number of people. And with a molecule like cholesterol, where everybody's aware that cholesterol has deleterious consequences if it's mishandled, means that there's an awareness that you should move forward. And so once a target has been found, I think companies are recognizing that it's not worth ignoring.
Stephen Sturley is a professor at Barnard College and Columbia University studying Niemann-Pick disease type C. He's also a member of the Scientific Advisory Board for the National Niemann-Pick Disease Foundation. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. The Perseid meteor shower is at its peak right now. If you're the super early morning type, like 3 a.m. early, it can make for a great light show. But researchers at NASA keep an eye on events like this for different reasons, not least the risk they can pose to satellites and spacecraft in Earth's orbit. Bill Cook leads NASA's Meteoroid Environment Office, and he joins me now. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What is the Perseid meteor shower? Where do all of these meteors come from?
Well, in general, meteor showers are caused when the Earth runs into a stream of debris left behind by a comet or an asteroid as it moves in its orbit around the sun. The Perseids are caused by the debris left behind by Comet Swift-Tuttle, which is one of the bigger comets in the solar system. And every year in August, in middle of August, we run into the debris trail. And when that debris hits our atmosphere at 132,000 miles per hour, it burns up and leaves these brilliant streaks of light we call Perseid meteors.
That makes it sound pretty dramatic with the speeds involved. But as you were saying, we're passing through the debris field of the comet. It's not that the comet is moving close past us at this point, right?
That's correct. As comets move around the sun heats them up, and the ice turns to vapor, and that gas carries with it these particles, these debris particles, and they stream out along the orbit of the comet. So the comet orbit has this ring of dust particles, and we run into that ring every year in mid-August. We don't want to be close to the comet. That would be a very bad day. Fortunately, that does not happen.
How many of these comet debris fields are? Because it seems like if you go look for a meteor shower viewing calendar, there's a meteor shower that you could see on a regular basis pretty much every month of the year.
Oh, yeah. If you look at the International Astronomical Union's list of meteor shower, there are hundreds of them.
If there are hundreds of meteor showers that we're passing through every year, how many comets are there total in our solar system?
Oh, I couldn't even begin to venture to guess. We keep discovering new ones every day. So hundreds, thousands of comets, some of which pass near Earth.
Bill Cook, NASA's Meteoroid Environment Office, part of what you're doing is keeping track of potential risks. And as you've said, some comets pass close to Earth. Many of them do not. And it's just these debris fields. Do these meteoroids, these meteor showers, pose any risk to Earth?
Meteor showers don't, certainly, because a Perseid burns up harmlessly above your head about 50 miles up. So you could go outside and watch the Perseids and not worry about being bonked on the head because the atmosphere protects you. If the Perseid screams in at 132,000 miles per hour, it heats up and vaporizes. Out in space, there's no atmosphere. So those particles can strike the surfaces of spacecraft or hit solar arrays or even astronauts on EVAs. That's why we monitor meteor shower activity. So basically, we can tell spacecraft and manned vehicles when to batten down the hatches.
I mean, that's presumably about all you can do to manage this risk. There's no way to avoid this debris field, no way to move the debris out of the way, right? So it's really just a matter of trying to get anything valuable out of their way.
That's right. Think of it just like a storm warning. You can't do anything about the storm, but you can warn people to get out of its way and to stay indoors for safety.
How do the risks posed by a comet's debris field compare to things like other asteroids or other objects, or for that matter, all of the human-caused debris that's floating around in Earth's orbit all of the time?
Well, a lot of people think that meteor showers pose the biggest risk to astronauts and space vehicles because they're visually impressive. You go outside on a typical Perseid peak night and you see like a meteor per minute, and there are these spectacular streaks of light. And people have the impression from those displays and from the movies that meteor showers are this enormous risk to spacecraft. The truth is that the meteor background, on any given night, you can go outside and see anywhere from 5 to 8 meteors per hour, and that's the meteor background. And that's always there, and that poses much more of a risk than the meteor showers do. So if you compare the risk posed by the meteor background, which accounts for 90% of the meteor threat to spacecraft to orbital debris, the answer is it varies with where your orbit is in Earth. At space station altitudes, where our astronauts reside, the risk is about 50-50. 50% comes from meteoroids, 50% comes from orbital debris. You get higher, say, at sun synchronous altitude where the Landsats and other unmanned spacecraft are. And at those altitudes, you know, the risk, meteoroids are less than 1% because there's so much space junk at those higher altitudes.
Bill Cook, NASA's Meteoroid Environment Office a few years ago put out an app asking for those who do go out to view the Perseids and other meteor showers to actually use this app to help count meteors and meteoroids. What was it you were hoping to get out of all of that data?
Some idea, better idea of the relative activity. We have meteor cameras situated around the U.S., and there are other camera networks. But it turns out that one of our best sources of information, even after, you know, decades, are still people outside counting meteors because there's so many people. And, you know, you would think a camera would be better, but if I compare the data from one camera to thousands of people, it turns out that the sheer numbers of observers give better data than that single camera. So, you know, it's kind of like crowdsourcing meteor observations.
All right. With all of the serious stuff aside, these are, as you've mentioned, just really beautiful if you can manage to be awake at the right time of night. Can you give us some viewing tips for how to best enjoy the Perseids?
Well, meteor shower observing is the best form of observing there is. It's the easiest. All you have to do is go outside, get comfy, lie flat on your back, and look straight up with your eyes.
I think most of us can manage that.
Yeah. No telescopes, no binoculars. Just go outside, get comfy, lie flat on your back, and look straight up. The two caveats there that most people ask me about is, number one, you've got to give your eyes enough time to adapt to the dark. So, you know, that's 30 to 45 minutes. Don't expect to go outside, stand on your front porch, and expect a Perseid to suddenly materialize. That's number one. Number two is avoid looking at your cell phone while you're observing meteors, because the light from the cell phone trashes your night vision. And a lot of people will be outside and observing, looking for Perseids at the same time, texting and other things, and the cell phone screen's light just messes your night vision. So those are the basic tips.
Maybe also grab a caffeinated beverage, because we're talking about 3 a.m., right?
Oh, yes. Meteor showers are not great respecters of people's sleep. So, yes, you're talking early morning. I am now, you know, getting up in years, and except for a few rare occasions, I tend to sleep in and let my meteor cameras do the observing for me.
Bill Cook leads NASA's Meteoroid Environment Office. Thanks so much for talking with us, and enjoy the Perseids.
Okay.
Up next, why science needs the humanities if we're going to get a handle on climate change. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Climate change is often portrayed and perceived as a science issue. We need science to understand the causes and impacts, and we need new technologies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and adapt to inevitable changes. But science alone can't solve climate change. For that, my next guests argue, we're going to need ethics and art and literature and, quite frankly, every discipline out there. Stephen Allison is professor of ecology and evolutionary biology and earth system science at the University of California, Irvine, and Tyrus Miller is the dean of the School of Humanities there. Together, they've written about why science needs the humanities to solve climate change. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So science alone is not enough. Honestly, seems like kind of a no-brainer. Why did you feel that it was necessary to write this piece for theconversation.com and make that case?
Well, we thought that it was good to get the word out that here at UC Irvine and other places around the country and around the world, that scientists are trying to think more broadly. They're trying to think outside their scientific box and interact with scholars from across the campus and from across many different disciplines. And I think that the motivation for this was that we aren't making enough progress in climate action and addressing this huge grand challenge of climate change that's facing our generation.
Well, Tyrus Miller, make that case that artists and social scientists and authors, that all of these scholars of the humanities should be an integral part of addressing climate change. What is it that they bring to the table?
Well, I think that one of the things that we know from increasingly from the science is the role that human beings have played in bringing about this major change in our climate. And we need to understand those human factors that lie behind it. What kind of motivational factors, what kinds of cultural factors, and then also what kinds of values do we bring to bear in our relationship to the environment, either in a negative way or in a positive way that will help to repair and positively affect our relationship to the environment. So this is an area where humanists really specialize in those kinds of questions from the different disciplines of philosophy, of literature, of art. And we have important insights really to bring to bear. It's in no way to say that we don't need the science and we don't need as much technical ingenuity and expertise to deal with these problems, but we need to understand the human domain to really be able to make effective and ethical choices and to motivate people to adopt these kinds of solutions.
You, in your piece on theconversation.com, give multiple examples of, you know, dance companies with performances that are about climate change, or referencing the entire new literary genre of cli-fi, climate-based, typically fairly apocalyptic fictional writing. Obviously, scholars in the humanities are already taking on the issue of climate change. Does your collaboration and this idea of working closely together between natural scientists and social scientists and others in the humanities seem rare?
It's not completely rare. There's, I think, an increasing awareness that we need to work together in these ways. And we can point to a number of different efforts, some major voices, like, for instance, the Indian novelist Amitav Ghosh, about 10 years ago, wrote a very important book called The Great Derangement, which was a challenge to writers to say, we writers aren't really stepping up to the plate and helping people to imagine what the effects of climate change will be and ways in which we might imagine a better world or a better outcome. So I think that people are beginning this discussion, but it's a difficult one. We are used to being in our separate domains and not working together, and we're still moving towards ways in which we can frame a common language, understand each other's ways of working and thinking. And it's an exciting possibility, but it's one that really takes a lot of work and a lot of patience.
I want to speak from the science perspective, too. The arts are not just a medium for communicating science, but they are, in their own right, valuable and important components of culture. Science has a role to play in understanding these other disciplines in a more complete and more nuanced way than we have in the past.
Well, Stephen Allison, as the natural scientist in your particular duo, I guess scientists have really been put in the hot seat. And I'm thinking about things like congressional testimony, where officials are turning to scientists to say, what is the scope of the problem? What are the possible solutions? And scientists are usually very careful to try to say, well, here is what we could do. Here are the likely outcomes if we were to do those things. Mm-hmm. But it's often misconstrued, and it's become very politicized and very polarized. It seems that what the humanities bring to that is the should instead of the could, right? Actually getting at those values and what should we do? Do you think that by more deeply involving those in the humanities, it could perhaps depolarize some of the debate around the science of climate change?
I think that's a hope here for sure. Depoliticizing, depolarizing the issue of climate change is a big challenge. It's probably as big of a challenge as understanding the scientific basis for climate change, I would argue. So definitely humanities and other disciplines have a role to play there. But I really agree with what you're saying, that you know the science has a limit in terms of what people can take from it. They need to have this sort of moral perspective and ethical perspective, thinking about the human dimensions of the science. And I think a good example of this is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, which is the conglomeration of all of the results of scientific studies that the United Nations puts together every few years. And if you look in this report, it's very almost sterilized. There are not judgments made about which solutions should be adopted. So the scientists can say, you know, here are all your options. And it's actually very dangerous for a scientist to say, oh, well, you should use this particular option. And that's why we need other people at the table, people with cultural sensitivity, scholars who understand the cultural and ethical context of those different policy options.
I also would add that I think that climate is a kind of abstraction. We experience weather, we experience our immediate natural environment. It's very hard for people to have an intuitive relationship to the processes that are being described as climate change. It's not just weather is hotter in the summer or something like that. And we tend to experience these kinds of intuitable ideas through stories, through images, through expressions of art. And it helps people get an intuitive grasp of something that is actually very complex and very abstract and difficult to understand in an intuitive way. So I think that the challenge of humanist and also of creative artist is to try to take that abstraction and make it something that is tangible and experienceable for people so that they can actually begin to think about it in ways that are guiding their decision making.
To that point, you know, you've already mentioned how the humanities could perhaps deepen what comes out of those reports from the UN, but there are already examples where the very climate models on which we are basing decision making are being influenced by those in the humanities. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I thought that was really interesting, and I was looking for some examples of, you know, how the humanities have influenced the process of climate science. And I was very curious to see the origin of the term scenario. And scenarios are actually summaries of theater that were developed in the Italian Baroque period. And the scenario is meant as kind of a pitch for what was coming up in the next play or something. And so that principle gets applied through language to our broader culture and in this case to climate models, which use what are called scenarios or kind of storylines for different trajectories of society and society's energy use and society's decisions. And what I thought was interesting about that history of the term scenario is that there's an opportunity to come up with a much better pitch, a much broader range of ideas or visions for how the future might look, because the scientific world tends to constrain that vision to be, you know, what do we have today in terms of technology? What are the options that we have now that are kind of conservative? And they're not necessarily thinking about this kind of global stage of how society and culture can evolve over decades or even 100 years. And so I think if we have that perspective, that's what it's going to take to make the massive societal transformations that we're going to need to address the climate problem.
I love that idea of climate modeling as improv theater, essentially. And obviously, if we radically change the scenarios that we include in climate models, or radically change the options or the context of what we consider in things like UN reports, that has the potential to influence decision-making at very high levels. I wonder how you think that a broader understanding and a greater involvement of the humanities in the climate change issue might change public attitudes about climate change and perhaps individual decision-making and individual actions.
One of the things that I've realized in engaging with this issue and thinking even about my own life, we mentioned in the article some historical work about the rise of a kind of California culture of suburbia and highways and the kind of celebration of the car as a symbol of personal freedom and independence. And as a long-term resident of California and as an American who really grew up in the age of this kind of petro-utopia and, myth of fossil fuel and the automobile, I'm looking at my own life and thinking about when I was 15 and the symbol of being independent from my parents was, you know, getting that driver's license and being able to go out in the car.
Absolutely. That is such a coming-of-age marker for our society at this point.
So many of us, have that experience. And I think just highlighting those kinds of ways in which our identity, our sense of value, our sense of freedom is entangled with our consumption of fossil fuels at least puts us in a state of mind to be able to reflect about the kinds of choices that we make. How much does my identity, my sense of freedom depend on this? And how do I begin to sort that out and disentangle it in ways that I can make better choices for our future?
I would add to that also the big scale decisions that we have to make about tackling climate change, whether we adapt to it or whether we mitigate it. Those really have to do with a cultural decision. And there are very different consequences for different groups of people, for indigenous people, for example, whether we, just try to build seawalls and keep the ocean from encroaching onto our wealthy enclaves in the United States or the Western world, versus taking action to mitigate and actually reduce our consumption of fossil fuels and thereby globally reduce the impacts of climate change.
Stephen Allison is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology and earth system science at the University of California, Irvine. Tyrus Miller is dean of the School of Humanities there, and together they've written about why science needs the humanities to solve climate change. You can find that piece on theconversation.com. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.